Good morning. I too greet you in Jesus' name. Brother Brendan is right that we both share a mutual fear that we will plow each other's fields. And we talked about it ahead of time, but I have chosen to think about it like I am the second robot in front of Martin Accounting mowing the yard. And you watch that thing and it goes out and it drives around for a while and it parks and it rests. It'd be like the second one that comes out and starts mowing behind it. And now the first mower might say, this second one, I did mow there. I know I'm mowing as I go over here. And it'll all work. Till the end of the week, the whole grass will be mowed. Open your Bibles to Mark chapter 8. We are looking at a mini sermon that Jesus preached, and we are using it as the foundation for many considerations. And you can do this with the words of Jesus, for his words, well, they are never wasted. His messages were timely, they were compact, and they were instructive. And this morning we are going to attempt a fourth message on the fourth verse of a five-verse sermon. And when he had called the people unto him with his disciples also, he said unto them, whosoever will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whosoever will save his life shall lose it, but whosoever shall lose his life for my sake in the Gospels, the same shall save it. For what shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? Whosoever therefore shall be ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him also shall the Son of Man be ashamed when he cometh in his Father with the holy angels." We are recognizing that the word whosoever shows up four times. I'm just going to recap just a few moments for the benefit of those who thought they were too old to come the other times. But we are looking at that word whosoever. It's there four times. This passage is repeated in Matthew 16, Luke 9, and here. And in all of them, the language, even though it's not always the same words, it will always come across. It will make the point in the invitation form. Whosoever, is there anybody? If a man will come after me, let him take up his cross and follow me. And we are beginning every meditation with the honest reality that no man is forced into the kingdom. You might take a child and grab him by his rooster tail and make him pick up his toys, but that is not what Jesus is doing here. He is standing and he is calling, like on the street to the man at the table, come, Matthew, follow me. And Matthew comes and goes. But then what's happening in the rest of this little mini sermon is that Jesus begins to talk about other choices that you can make as an alternate. As the other way you could go. Brendan showed it with a why, but his summary is absolutely correct, except that when this whole thing boils down, we soon find out that when it comes to taking my way, there's really a zillion ways you can go. As long as we have life, we can guess. And you know, there are things that people will pursue from their youth with the whole heart, and it's not God's way, but it's not the same as what the one across the street does. Okay. Whosoever, if a man, whosoever, he calls to come after him, and he gives these two factors. If you deny yourself and you take up your cross, and we studied that in fairly deeply, what that looks like, what that is. And then he makes this next statement in verse 35, that if you take your own way, whosoever will save, and we noted that the word will has the element of desire to it. It is a wish. It is a plan. It is whosoever will save. This is what I want to do to save. And the word save means to protect, deliver, or bring into a safe place. And so what you have is Jesus simply in a very compact way saying, you know, if somebody really wants to take hold of their life and get a grip on it and do something with themselves, and their wish is to do it a certain way, beware. For whosoever will save shall lose. And the word shall is not the same as the word will. The word shall is a contractual term. It is something like a guarantee. If you do go that way, we can guarantee you that's what will happen. If you will walk off the end of the pier, you shall fall in the water. It's life. That's the formula. If you decide to do that, then we know what's going to come next. And Jesus says, if you want to save your life, if you will save your life, you shall lose it. And the word lose is a destructive term. You'll break apart, you'll go to pieces. And then we've been looking at a couple of different possibilities of how this can be done in life. And we now come to verse 37, which again is a question. It's another way that Jesus is still exploring possibilities of how you might want to or wish or desire to save yourself, but you will lose, you will implode, you will self-destruct. And he asks this question, or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? Now, the key word in this verse is exchange, which means an equivalent or a ransom. And I will want to go to a market yet in my life where we can do bartering. I think that would be fun to do. I'm not talking about going into the market and he says, I want so many taka for this painting, and I offer him 1,000 less, and we banter back and forth until we meet in the unhappy medium. I'm talking about where you look at the man and say, I would like that painting. I will give you my horse for the. And he looks at my horse and he says, well, that horse is no good. Look how short his tail is. And I say, yes, but inside he's a very strong horse. And we barter this thing back and forth. And that's what Jesus is talking about. He says, now I want to know what the possibilities are. When you think about saving and losing, what are the possibilities that you could take your soul and start to play and barter it away? And what could you actually take, this breath of God that's within your body, what could you take and step up to the marketplace and go down to the stand and say to the man, I'll give you this for that? And yet, in human experience, it is not a strange concept at all that a person would exchange. I think it's more commonly called in English selling your soul. And it's just simply where you take that life that God has placed within you and you throw it away. No, that's too strong. We'll keep it soft right now. You exchange it for that. And you don't have to live very long until you start to bump into the stories. And this is especially true if you go along to New York for Jesus, and there you stand on the street, and they come down, the specimens of humanity in the highways, and they're coming in droves, and you start to meet the people. But I'll just tell you a secret. If you have a little bit of bravery and you walk down the street of your local town, you'll find them too. They're not very far away. Actually, I find that if I have the courage to just stop over at the neighbor's and talk with him, I find the same kind of thing. People that are in their 60s and 70s and 80s, and they're trying to figure out what to do next because they have done the exchange. They've put out a life of what they thought it should be. And there's many ways that this can be done. And the title of the message is Forever Young. And it's focusing just on one way that a person who decides to save his life will sell his soul. Maybe that's still too strong, but he'll at least exchange it. Forever Young is my best attempt at a catchy title. And so I've never been very good with titles. And so if when we're all done, you say, he didn't even preach what the title is about. Well, that has happened before. In the list that the commentary had, it said that one of the ways people exchange their soul is they try to stop the aging process. In other words, they try to keep themselves being young, or at least looking young. And I want to try to help you understand how that pursuit can be, at a minimum, exchange, and at a maximum, deadly. To preserve our youth, you know, the fact that I don't really look like many of you is inevitable. I was warned ever since I was your age that this was coming, that I would get kind of creased around the eyes and the hair. No, it was blonde and curly when I was 2 or 3 years old, and now it's straight and almost white. What did I do wrong? Nothing. Some of yours fell out. But it's normal. It is normal. And there's nothing to be ashamed of when you look your age. Except that, for reasons that I don't totally have figured out, there is a tremendous cultural, social, human push to knock that thing off before it gets a hold of us for real. And this is one of the ways that we can amp up our own self-preservation to the point that we'll just simply slide our soul out and exchange it. I'd like to make 2 points in the beginning here. Number one is that I do believe that I am called as a human being to be a steward of my body. Take the book of 1 Corinthians, and there's at least 3 references that teach this principle very clear. And they must be said because I do hope to somehow lay a balance before us that in the option to save ourselves by trying to stay young, we can also miss a biblical point. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, these are all verses I'm sure you know. Verse 19, what? Know ye not that your body is the temple of the Holy Ghost, which is in you, which you have of God, and ye are not your own? For ye are bought with a price. Therefore glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's. And this is one of the foundational scriptures that is used to tell young people you ought not to smoke, because it is a defilement of the temple. God made it. Tobacco corrupts. Vaping corrupts. Don't do it. It's not even scriptural. Okay. That's how the teaching goes. And it's true. We are called to be stewards of our own body. Now go to chapter 9. Verse 25. And every man that striveth for the mastery is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a corruptible crown. He's talking about being a runner in a race. Now they do it to obtain a corruptible crown, but we are incorruptible. I therefore so run, not as uncertainty, so fight I, not as one that beateth the air, but I keep my body and bring it under subjection, lest by any means when I preach to others, I myself should be a castaway. So he's talking now about, he's looking at sports runners, and he's saying there's a lot of training and there's a lot of self-discipline that goes in to be able to run that marathon. I don't know if there's anybody here that can run 30 miles this afternoon. I do know people that can, but that didn't happen overnight. It is a self-discipline. And the Bible calls us. Paul says, this is what I do for myself, because I actually believe that if I am not a steward of my body through discipline, I could possibly be a castaway of the gospel. And it actually can work that way. And so it's always proper to eat correctly, to eat healthy, and to get some exercise. Don't sit at your computer all day. Get out and move around. You were made to walk. And respect your body. Be a steward of it. 1 Corinthians 10:31 is going to teach us that whether we therefore eat or drink, whatsoever you do, do all to the glory of God. And now there is a call for you to use your body in such a way that when you have done that which you are about to do, it can be counted for as a glory to God. And that actually is a very broad statement, but it actually pushes right into the creeks and crevices of our experiences and says, oh, there is some restrictions here. And I believe in the stewardship of the body. However, I also am familiar with a world in where even well-meaning stewardship runs amok, and people can actually amp up this thing under the banner of stewardship that they are taking care of themselves until they are no longer serving the kingdom. It's actually a possibility. And whenever I think of that thought, I have to go back to a story that happened just a couple miles down the road, years ago. And I got to tell a little bit of context so that you understand the story. But I grew up on a farm just a few miles south of here, across the road, was a farmer, and he was a big farmer. He was an energetic farmer. Those of us that knew Mr. Ziegler knew he was a ripper. He was up early, he was out all day, and even after we had parked our equipment and we were calling it a day and we boys were going swimming, he was still out chopping haylage. Type A personality, I think you call that. I remember the night he decided he needed another pond next to the pond he had, and he went out there with his Fiat Alice payloader, and he was out there all night long, just pushing dirt. And that's the kind of person he was. He got older, and eventually he got off the farm, phased out, and his son took over. Now, he had two sons. The one was an older, and the other was a younger. The older son was very mild-mannered and laid back. He wasn't quite so much of a ripper. And he was there. He was on the farm. The second son was a lot in personality like his dad, except he never gave his life to the Lord. And at 16, he ran away, ran out west, joined a combine crew. And I think it was about 10 years that the second son was out there in the west just living it up, full throttle. But the day came that sort of like a prodigal son, he came to the end of himself and came back home. Through that experience, he was converted, and he became a very energetic Christian. That's how we knew him, as a neighbor man, ready to speak for the Lord. He was one that if you bumped into him, you could expect sooner or later the things of conversation were going to turn to spiritual things, because he had gotten saved and that was the most important subject in his life, even more than his farm. But as Dad got older, he started looking for a place to, I guess, to keep that high energy, even though his body couldn't keep up and do the farming. And he became very interested in I guess the simplest phrase is natural health. And he put the same unction and push into finding the I guess those springs down in Florida that De Leon, whatever his name, the Spanish explorer that wanted them, the fountain, you go into them, you dip in them, you come out just like a 20-year-old. And he would never say that's what he was doing, but he would say things like, you don't have to be sick. And he would say things like, there's always a solution out there, but people aren't willing to see it. And he would try some, we thought they were crazy things. I mean, I remember the day I was talking to the dad, and he was telling me how good hydrogen peroxide is for you. And he said, you know, you can drink this stuff straight. And he said, it has all that oxygen in it. And when you drink it, it goes down in you, and all that oxygen goes straight into your bloodstream. And he said, it'll make you feel 30 years younger. Well, I was in water treatment, and I work with 35% hydrogen peroxide. And I said, well, it'll burn the skin off your throat the whole way down. He said, not if you drink it real fast. Are you serious? Oh, yeah. And he said, keep your head tilted straight up, because he said, it'll foam out your mouth. And he said, it'll choke you if you don't swallow it right. I'm looking at this man. He was serious. He believed that if you swallowed straight hydrogen peroxide, it would make you go. And he networked with another fellow that they had this supplement program. I forget what it was actually called. But they were sure that if you took this and used it right, you could live to be 120. And they would say this. And at least I heard him say it. And they took these pills. And one day I was talking with the son. He came into Martin's for some salt for his water softener. And we were standing behind the shop talking. And I asked him how his dad is doing. And he rolled his eyes and said, he's as crazy as he ever was. He said, you know, recently I told Pop, I said, if you try as hard to get people into heaven as you do to keep them out, you could actually be useful. What was the son talking about? Okay, what actually happened in that story is that the dad got cancer in his 70s and died about 45 years earlier than he thought he should have. But right there is one of those illustrations of where a person got misguided in the whole drive to take care of themselves, protect themselves, and when they were done, his son could figure it out that this whole drive was actually missing the point. If you would try as hard to help people get to heaven as you are trying to keep them out, you could actually be useful. If he got his wish, he'd have kept people out of heaven for 45 years. I guess we don't think of that too often. There are many ways that this drive to stay young, to be forever young, to stop the aging process happens. And it's just one of the ways that I know that a soul can be exchanged. You have the vitamin programs, you have the mineral programs, supplements. Modern medicine, well, actually old medicine, has been trimmed around the edges with these options. You can read right back through the books. It's out there. Take so many milligrams of this, and then you will have that. And the claims have gone on all my life. But none of them did a thing for COVID. Sort of did. A couple sort of did, but not quite. And it's a mystery to many people how much is true and how much is untrue. How much is mystical, how much is testimonial based. But it's out there, and it's one of the options. It's one of the methods that a person can use and can feed a drive to just stay forever young, just keep the wrinkles away, keep that big toothy smile on your face, and be able to run with the best. But deep down in, we know that there's nothing a 60-year-old can do to keep up with a 20-year-old. There's actually nothing you can do. That's the way it is. But we use testimonies. I see that. It's very effective. And I don't want to belittle testimonies because I know that when it comes to a testimony, it's one of the most effective tools you have to speak for Christ under the sun, as we say. Just go ahead and say what Jesus did for you, and people can't gainsay that. They can say, no, he doesn't. Oh, yes, he did it for me. Okay, and this is actually the bridge of what many of these programs build on. That doesn't work. Oh, yeah, it did for me. And then what do you say next? And it's something that can really gobble people up. But, you know, the testimonies can be sincere. They can be surprising. And there's even a few I've bumped into already that struck me as highly ridiculous. I remember reading the ad in one of the periodicals. I think it was the Busy Beaver has that whole section in with these kind of things in, and there was one that just made me chuckle out loud. It said that it's very effective, that people testify, 40% of the people that take this product feel 50% better 30% of the time. Now, I love math, and so I ran through the numbers, and that's what made me laugh. Can you do math? If you start with the number 100 times 40%, well, that's down to 40 people. Times 50%, now you're down to 20. Times 30%, you're down to 6. So this product, out of 100 people trying it, sort of felt better. Six of them would say they felt better. Well, that's nice, but that's not really anything to sell. But it sells. And it just goes to show the energy that we are open to receive if somebody can just help us to feel better. And I don't think there's anything wrong with wanting to feel better. I have my days I wish I felt better too. And I have done things to try and feel better. But the problem is still stands at the back of the room and says, but what's it worth to you? How far are you going to push this? And when will you come to a fork in the road and you'll just simply say, I'm going to follow Jesus instead of taking my way and try to live to be 120. And it's amazing what people will do. You know, there are sad stories out there. Some of them are within my wife and I's family tree of people that have taken these products hoping for something good to happen, and something awful stands in its place. I remember the woman that got smitten with carrot juice, and she took it and got the benefits of it until she was an orangish yellow in her skin. And this happens. People will chase that kind of thing until it tells on them. I brought a picture along I want to show you, and this is just a photo of what happens if you take too much colloidal silver. Now, I don't know if you've ever heard of colloidal silver, but it is fragments of silver, which silver does actually have, we know this from water treatment, silver does have properties that will kill bacteria and viruses. But this man took colloidal silver. He used to look like that, and by the time he was an old man, and this is not a Photoshop picture. This man has argia, and argia is when there's enough of silver deposits in your bloodstream that the pigment of your skin turns blue. And he looks bluer because he has a blue shirt on, but you can Google argia and just get reams of photos of what happens when you chase all the benefits of colloidal silver until they get you right out through the skin. And what shall a man give in exchange? Well, that would be an exchange for your body, I believe. You turn blue. Why? In the interview, there's an interview. This man has been interviewed on the different networks, the Oprahs. This picture's about 8 years old. But they asked him, why did you do it? And he said, well, he heard all the benefits of colloidal silver, which is ironic because you can't actually find medical journals that have researched it and will back up the claims that the colloidal silver manufacturers make. But he said he read about all the benefits and he decided that it was worth the risk because he knew that would happen to some people if they overdid it, but he wasn't going to overdo it. Well, I'll let you decide if he did or he didn't. It's what happens. Well, that's just one way. There's people that have destroyed their relationship with their brotherhood and their church and even their Christian life because they were so determined to have their products, to market them, to use them, and to be good to other people. And this thing of trying to stop the aging process or be forever young can actually get a hold of you with a grip until you sell out things that that you ought never have to let go. Another area where people try to stop the aging process is in the artificial world. I call it artificial, and maybe that's not the right term, but I'm going to talk now about cosmetics and plastic surgery or surgery people will do to try and save themselves. Cosmetics is the care, it is products that are used for personal care. And there's 7 categories: oral care, skin care, sun care, hair care, decorative care, body care, and perfumes. And these cosmetics is a big business. You don't have to research long to know that there is literally billions of dollars in the cosmetic industry. And one of the sneaky things about the cosmetic industry is that toothpaste is considered a cosmetic because you brush your teeth with it and you try not to build up plaque and get cavities. And so that's a very functional cosmetic. At the other end of the spectrum is something like eyeshadow or nail polish, which has no functional purpose other than people are supposed to think you look nicer after you put it on than before you did. And that's the way the cause. And you have this whole spectrum, and it's all out there for the buying. And most of these products are not 50 cents and a dollar. They're going to start at 10 or 12 and go up. You don't have to walk the aisle at Walmart, but if you do, just notice. And what they are for is for people that are trying to hide that what you see happening to me. It's just... you know, if you put, I don't know, this cream, it just makes your wrinkles go away. For what? Why do my wrinkles need to go away? Well, because I'll look nicer. what happened to me is that I stopped caring about what I look, even to the fault of my family faults me for it. I've given up on all that. But you know, when we want to really live and we're trying to make it last a long time, there are people that spend thousands of dollars, maybe ten thousands of dollars on annual budgets because they are 70 and they just wish they could look 40 again. And there's ways to do it. And then you get into the whole surgery world, and there is plastic surgery that is out there. Plastic surgery is something that is big business as well. There's always a company that puts billboards on the way down to Altoona every spring. Come to us, and we'll get you ready for the beach. We'll carve you up, we'll inject you, we'll clean you out, and you'll be ready to walk with very little clothing on down the beach. And that's their push. They're plastic surgeons. Plastic surgery is a surgical specialty that involves restoration, reconstruction, or alteration of the human body. It can be divided into two main categories: reconstructive surgery, cosmetic surgery. Reconstructive surgery includes cranial facial surgery, hand surgery, microsurgery, and the treatments of burns. Many years ago, I was working at a plus 55 community back here at Troxville, just outside of Allentown. And the maintenance fellow, the first time I met him, looked terrible. He had gotten cancer on his face, and it had spread up, and they had done surgery, and they had carved away. It was a big hole here. And it looked horrible to just stand there and talk to him. And I actually asked him, I said, "Joe, how do you eat?" And he said, "Well, it's kind of a messy arrangement." But the cancer had thrown away. About 6 months later, I was there, and his face was all bandaged up. They had done some kind of reconstructive surgery and closed up the hole. And about 6 months after that, I met him again. And you could tell that but he was functional. He could eat without his food falling all over the table because they had reconstructed. And that's plastic surgery. And there are places for burns, all kinds of things. But the big industry in the plastic surgery world is still trying to help people stay looking like they're 20 years younger than what they actually are. Inject a little Botox here, take a tuck away there, and we can do it without any scars showing. But why? What's the drive? What's the push? Why do you need to do that? And what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? Plastic surgery can run amok. Got another picture for you, and I'm sorry, I'm an old man, and so I think of the illustrations of people from my time. Anybody know who this is? He died in 2009. Is this too old? You probably don't know this person, do you? Anybody know who this is? Michael Jackson. Michael Jackson. This man, when I was 17, was ruling the charts. He was a dancer like no other. He defined what moonwalking was, and the boys on the street. If you ever go down to the Boston Harbor, and there are boys there, or young men, that will crank up the music and dance and twirl and creep and crawl and shuffle across it, Michael taught them to do that. Okay, he was a rock star, and but he had a problem, and that is, well, we talked about this already this week, but you know, when you get famous, you get lonely. It's really lonely at the top. But not only do you get lonely, but you get kind of mixed up in your brain. And you start thinking that something's wrong with me because I'm lonely. There must be something wrong. And what some people do, and what Michael did, is he started going to the plastic surgeons. Now, this man says, it's Dr. Yon, who was one of his surgeons, is just shaking his head, and he's saying, this man has a disorder in his brain. I think it was more of a spiritual disorder than what Dr. Yon does, but he says that he had BDD, which is a psychiatric condition that makes it impossible to see oneself as others do. This unrealistic view causes the sufferer to undergo many or multiple plastic surgeries in a misguided attempt to correct a defect, one that was never there to begin with. That's the man. And at 52 years old, he would die. And he would be the doctor who was treating him would be accused of murder because the man could not sleep. He had gone 30 hours without sleeping, and he had a concert coming up, and he begged the doctor to come. And they basically put him under anesthesia to try and sleep. And he died about a half hour later. And the way he went to his grave is all carved up, like you see on the right. And what will a man give in exchange for his soul? This man was driven to look like this. This is what he looked like when I was a teenager. And this is what he looked like 20 years later. And he's been gone since 2009. But it is the desire to stay young, to look fresh, to be highly desired in appearance forever. And it gets a hold of us, and it makes us want to sell anything to get that back. Now, Jesus has an answer for this, and he has a whole way of thinking. And I just want to talk about this in closing. In a way, I'm going to sound like Brendan. We're going to be mowing some of the same grass. But it's there, and you need to think about it to keep you from actually turning into the next Michael Jackson. Now, you're never going to be, most of you are never going to be that famous, that wealthy, and that driven to hang on to what's getting away from you. But you might be in some way. And I just want you to think about some truths that the Bible teaches. Go in your Bible to Hebrews chapter 10. We need to find some balance between stewardship of the body and this misguided drive to stay forever young. And I think the Bible will give us a balance. And if we just think about the pieces of this balance, it will actually help us be balanced. Hebrews chapter 10. I want to start reading at verse 4. For it is not possible that the blood of bulls and goats should take away sins. Wherefore, when he cometh into the world, he saith, sacrifice and offering thou wouldest not, but a body thou hast prepared me. In burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin thou had no pleasure. Then said I, lo, in the volume of the book it is written of me, to do thy will, O God. And it goes on to keep talking. Many years ago, I was on a farm, and there was a Baptist preacher there doing sales, being a salesman. But we ended up, neither of us, the farmer wasn't there, so we stood there and talked. And he told me that this is one of the oldest conversations in the Bible. He said it took place sometime before Jesus came. It seems like, with the words of Peter, that the salvation plan was formed before the foundation of the world, that just maybe Hebrews 10:5 is a conversation pre-creation, where Jesus and God are talking, and God is saying, you know, they're talking about how this creation is going to all work out. And there's going to be a sacrificial system, and we're going to have to come up with a better way. And then it says here that Jesus said, when he was going to come into the world, God, I know that you are not really liking the sacrificial system, but you're preparing a body for me. That's what God has done for all of us. You're preparing a body for me. And a man born blind, thou hast prepared a body for me. And a man that gets MD, muscular dystrophy, thou hast prepared a body for me. And the first thing that you and I must always, always, always remember is that we are prepared bodies. And that becomes very critical, particularly if you are going to surrender to God's way. That becomes very critical because you know that wherever the journey goes, it's going to end the way, if God is leading, it's going to end exactly where he prepared us to go, which is true of Christ. Brendan told us that the baby, no matter how sweet, how dear, how beautiful, If there were baby contests at Bethlehem, it's highly probable that Jesus would win as a baby. He's an incarnate one, Son of God, Son of Man. I know Isaiah says there is no beauty that we should desire him, but that seems to be in the context of after they've taken a stick and some other things to his face. A body thou hast prepared me. And it's the same for us. Is there anybody here that is born with a handicap this morning? That's not my fault. It's not even God's fault. It's just God's plan. It's a fallen world, and there will be people born blind. There will be people born, and there will just be a stump here. There will be genetic disorders. There will be, but a body thou hast prepared. And that principle stands supreme in the big picture. Go now to Romans chapter 12, and we're going to pull a single word out of a verse you know by memory. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that ye present your bodies a living sacrifice. And be not conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that ye may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. So now the phrase is not a prepared body, it's a presented body. And this is the second layer, if you please. You present your bodies a living sacrifice. Here am I, Lord, said Isaiah. Here am I is what you can say too. You can do with me what you want. This is following after Jesus. When Matthew stood up, he was saying, here am I. And away they went. And did they go to Capernaum? Matthew didn't know, but he was okay. He was going to Capernaum too, if that's where they went. He presented himself, and he would go on to become one of the apostles in the new kingdom. And if the martyr's mirror is correct, you can read of his end. I think it's correct. I don't have any reason to doubt it. But he gave his life, but it all started back one day at a money-changing table where a man said, here am I, I'll go with you. And we present our bodies, and Brendan used the word surrender. I'm going to use the word acceptance, and I'm pretty sure they're about the same thing. But this is real. It is impossible to try and deny the aging process, to pursue the 120-year-old destination of a journey and be in acceptance of who God made you to be. Now, that's a strong statement, but I mean what I say. It's impossible to do. And so, we are called to present our bodies a living sacrifice. And my life is surrounded with people that have been tested way beyond what I ever imagined on this very point, and yet it is true. One of my wife's old acquaintances has a disease, I think it's called Huntington's disease, and I don't know much about it, but I know that it is somehow muscular and nervous related, and I know that by now she is completely bedfast and probably doesn't have many more years to live no matter what pill she takes or what surgery she gets. But her testimony is that we often pray and we often rejoice in 2 Corinthians 12:9, where the scripture says, my grace is sufficient for thee, for my weak strength is made perfect in weakness. But then we stop. And we skip the black letters. We just like the red ones. Most gladly, therefore, will I rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. You cannot pursue staying in this old world just as long as you possibly can and rest in the glory of infirmity. Those are two gears that don't mesh. And we are called to present our bodies, which is a reasonable service. Go now to Acts chapter 20. Verse 24. This is where Paul is working his way back to Jerusalem. And not only are things not going to go very well for him, he is being prophesied against place after place that there's trouble ahead. But here in Acts 20, he's talking to the elders of Ephesus, and he's giving his testimony, and he's talking about his life, and he says in verse 22, "And now behold, I go bound in the Spirit unto Jerusalem, not knowing the things which shall befall me there, save that the Holy Ghost witnesses in every city, saying that bonds and afflictions abide in me. But none of these things move me, neither count I my life dear unto myself, so that I might finish my course with joy, and the ministry which I have received of the Lord Jesus to testify the gospel of the grace of God." And so we have a body that is prepared. We have a body that is presented, and we have a spirit that is unmoving in its acceptance, in its commitment. And he says that I'm not counting my life dear, and I'm going to simply accept the course that God has for me, and I'm going to do it with joy. It is no secret that misguided attempts at health and appearance have taken an ugly toll. I want to show you another picture, and then I want to just talk about that for a little bit. This might be hard to see, but I'll ask the young ladies to tell me. Do you know who this is? It's Mother Teresa. Do you know who this is? It's the same person. This is the year she left for India, 32 years old. She's now in her 90s. She has served the lepers of Calcutta for over 60 years. She could use some tucks. That face is sagging. But she's not interested. Mother Teresa, I don't know her well at all. I've read stories about her, but the stories project her or present her as somebody who accepted who she was, she presented her body, and she finished her course. And that's all I really want to say about her, but I'm just telling you this morning that when the Apostle Paul chose to follow Jesus, he had no clue where he was going. He actually asked the Lord right there on the Damascus Road, "Now what do I do next?" And he said, "We'll go into the town and it'll be told you what to do." And later, he would be taken away while he's in Arabia, and he would be told that he's going to be an apostle to the Gentiles. And he gives that testimony at the back of Acts. But once he had accepted who he was and presented himself, he was rewarded with an unmoving spirit that took him through life, and he was no longer interested in how long the course was or how short it was or whether he needed to do anything to make it take longer. He would say things like, "You know, it would be glorious to go and to be with Christ. For me to die is gain. To live is Christ. I'll stay here. This is what he wants." And here you have a woman that went down into the ghettos of Calcutta, India. And there's just no way that I can describe the squalor of where she lived for years. You haven't seen it. You might have seen one place in the bush country behind your house that sort of reminds you of it. But we're talking about streets and alleys and blocks and millions of people that live in squalor. And she willingly served there and live to be an old age. Not everybody does, but that's the story of our lives. I have brother-in-laws who are buried. They were ministers, but when cancer came calling, they could not find a pill or a radiation or anything to save them. But both of them died at rest in their 50s, early 50s. The last time I talked to the one, he told me, he said, "Well, if this is the end, it was a joyful life." Which made no sense to me because his dad had died of cancer when he was 3 years old. And after his mother had remarried again, they had loaned him out to serve with other farmers. And he'd be away, even in his young years, 10, 11, 12 years old, he was living somewhere besides his home. And he had so many things that he really could have put his finger on. But he had married a young lady, and they had carved out a decent life, and he was a minister in their church for a number of years, and then cancer struck, and it became the end. And he says, if this is the end, then it was a good life. But he was only 54. It doesn't matter if that's where God is leading. That's a sideshow of the story. And the day that I become obsessed with who I'm going to be as an old person, I have no clue how much Mother Teresa tried to live till she was 90-something. But if I know those kind of people, she probably put very little brain cells into it. She just simply got up and tended the wounds of the next leper that came crawling to her door, or she went to their hut. And it was the life she lived for God, and she is world-renowned as a servant. And I would just plead with us that somehow we would be able to let go of our demand on what our life needs to be or how long it ought to be. It's long ago now, time flies, but a few years ago, I was talking to a man, and he told me that he can't figure something out. He said, he knew 6 bishops in the plain churches that have Parkinson's disease. He said, I can't figure out what the connection is. And I said, well, I can't either. He said, do you ever worry about it? Well, not yet. But I still don't. I mean, I have no idea if there's actually a realistic tie between being a bishop and getting Parkinson's disease, even though he thinks he sees one. But I expect the work to sort of beat me up, and I expect that there's not a pill out there that'll make me live longer. And I'm sort of getting to the place where I'm okay with not having to live terribly long anyway. Because for me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. And I think if we can live on those terms, we don't need to worry about what a man will do or what a man will give or a woman will give in exchange for their soul. May the Lord bless you.